Good morning. Council, I don't know how many of you were here early, on any earlier day, but we've read your briefs. We've read the authority cited in your briefs. We've looked at least portions of the record. You only have 15 minutes per sign, so, yes. What is our issue? Pardon me one second, we've got maybe a technical issue. Okay, problem resolved. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs. We've looked at least portions of the record. In the limited time that you have, 15 minutes per side, you should feel free to get straight to the main points that you want to leave us with today. Everything you've written in your brief, of course, will still be under submission. You're not waiving anything by failing to discuss it today. We're going to probably have some questions, but be mindful of our traffic lights. When the red light shines, it is time to finish. Be mindful of our time. If you're answering a question, though, from the court, you can, of course, finish your answer. You won't lose rebuttal time if that's something that you have, but don't treat the red light as aspirational. United States versus Gibbonidio. I don't know if I pronounced that right, Ms. Webster, but you can let me know.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This court should reverse Mr. Benidio's convictions due to the individual and combined effect of the three evidentiary errors that were made at trial. First, the introduction of evidence about other investigations, including that the doctors had been indicted and convicted. Two, improper expert testimony from law enforcement officers. And three, the exclusion of evidence from Officer Tyler Benson that would have impeached the government's critical witness, Diane Fikes. The district court abused its discretion by admitting the testimony that other people had been investigated, indicted, and convicted. This testimony is inadmissible under Rules 401, 402, and 403 because the evidence is not relevant and because, as this court has repeatedly held...
Well, let me ask you this. So, you weren't trial counsel, right?
I was, actually.
Oh, you were? Okay.
I was second chair.
All right, so at trial, it seemed to me that y'all had already presented this information to the jury. Counsel did. That is, in opening statement, counsel explained that your client ran into people who were running their own scheme. They were people who were stealing prescriptions from doctor's offices, places like Express. People like the government's witnesses who are running their own scheme. Counsel said, "This you had co-counsel?"
I did have co-counsel, yes, Your
Honor. Yeah, I think he told the jury that some government witnesses were felons. He said he described Ms. Carter as a convicted felon, Ms. Fikes as a convicted felon. He asserted the prosecutors were depending on the words of those folks who've already been indicted and prosecuted. So before your Allen ever took the stand, counsel told the jury about these other people's convictions.
I think
right?
I disagree. I agree that that's what was stated. Okay. I disagree that that's the issue that's been presented on appeal. So specifically, the testimony or the opening statement was about the people that you just described were people who also testified at trial. And if people have testified at trial and you introduce evidence about their convictions, then that goes directly to their credibility and we have the chance to cross-examine them.
When Reed testifies, all he's saying, the fact that he mentions these very individuals' convictions, which is just a description of how things unfolded in the investigation, he's not introducing something even new to the jury. The defense counsel had already told the jury about this.
Your Honor, I, again, disagree with that because while we... in opening statement said that Mr. Benedio had encountered sort of a criminal crew, a criminal scheme. Those people referred to the people who were presenting the scripts, presenting the prescriptions to Mr. Benedio. And so at that point, that did not reference the doctors, that did not reference the clinic owners, it did not reference the people that, large numbers of the people that Jason Allen was describing. First, let me back up for 1 second because we moved in limine to exclude this evidence. The district court denied that motion, and the government got up and said, we intend to present this evidence because we think that it is relevant for the court, for the jury to know about these people who have been, that these prescriptions were issued, or the clinics and the doctors who issued these prescriptions were also subject to investigations.
Defense counsel told the jury that Express Health was a pill mill. On cross-examination of Carter, and before Allen took the stand, counsel inquired about criminal activity at Express Health. Counsel asked Carter, that's actually why you went to prison. Is that right? You were helping further participate in the pill mill, right?
And we got to cross-examine Ms. Carter about her actions and her activity, but we didn't get to cross-examine any of the other people that were referenced by Jason Allen and also mentioned by investigator or TFO officer Grimwatt. And so I would also note that the government pointed out this evidence in opening statement before our opening statement, and that when we asked...
objection.
We had already objected to it in the motion in limine, but I understand.
A motion in limine doesn't preserve it. You know that.
I do know that, Your Honor. That's why we did object every time it was brought up at trial. And I think that, so the issue is preserved. And then at the, I think the critical point, though, is that the evidence that we put up are the, when, first let me address Carter's testimony. When we asked Carter about her testimony at a prior trial, it was not to elicit testimony about Dr. Rowland's convictions or trial. We were trying to impeach her with her prior testimony. And so, although the government says that they did not intend to bring out this evidence at trial, the reality is that we did not intend to during the cross-examination of Carter, that I was just simply trying to orient her to the testimony to impeach her or to refresh her recollection. And so, in contrast, the government has stood up and said, we think this evidence is admissible, and they have the burden of proving, the cases say, beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless. And when you have that high of a burden to prove...
If there was error, if that was constitutional error...
Well, if
right,
you look at...
The reasonable doubt would be constitutional error. So first of all, I mean, if the government just... If this is something the witness said in explaining how the investigation unfolded... I'm not sure there's error, and it does appear to me that that's what happened. I also don't understand that that's necessarily constitutional error. But everything it seems like the witness said, well, what ultimately happened to Express Health, we shut them down, Carter was convicted, the clinic owner was convicted. I don't see how it's any different from anything defense counsel said, which would suggest no prejudice.
I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. I understand that generally the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is a it only relates to constitutional error. However, if you look at the decisions that we have cited, Eason and De La Vera, they specifically say that this issue is reviewed for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. So I believe that the government has the burden of proving that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So
if it was error.
If it was error, Your Honor. And I believe that it was error because we go back again to the government statements during the pretrial conference, the first day of trial. I guess it's not a pretrial conference at that point, but we objected to this testimony, and they got up and said, we anticipate that law enforcement officers will introduce this evidence, will testify that this happened, that these prescriptions came up in these other investigations, and that's important for the jury to know. So the idea
but that's just because they were explaining how the investigation unfolded, right?
But we still were not able to cross the cases say that there are two harms that come from this evidence, this type of evidence. One is that a jury will just rely on another jury's verdict instead of making its own determination. And the second is that we don't have the ability to cross-examine those people. We did not have the ability to cross-examine Dr. Rowland or any of the people, other people that were referenced. We didn't even have discovery about Dr. Rowland or about the other investigations. We objected at one point to testimony about that when that discovery was not provided. And so those harms or those problems are absolutely still an issue in this case because, again, when the jury has heard that 10 other people, including other pharmacists...
Your theory of defense was, look, my guy's just innocent. He's just, there are all these other people who are criminals. And that doesn't mean that he was doing anything wrong, that he understood what they were doing was wrong. And that's why you had already told the jury all these other folks were criminals.
I think that our defense was actually slightly more nuanced than that, because our defense was that the people who were bringing him the prescriptions were obtaining them fraudulently, and he did not know about that. The people who were bringing him the prescriptions.
Right.
But when the government got to introduce evidence that the doctors, that the clinic owners, that the people who would have been responsible for issuing the prescriptions, even aside from the other people, it told the jury that even setting aside the people who had defrauded Mr. Benedio, that even if the doctors had issued those prescriptions, he still shouldn't have filled them. That is why there is harm from this issue, because it goes beyond what our defense was and said, even if you agree with their defense, he shouldn't have been filling the prescriptions. And that's clearly harmful and detrimental to our defense.
So my question goes to your theory of defense, because in your brief you argue that the superseding indictment was insufficient to put your client on notice for purposes of creating a defense. But paragraph 16 of the superseding indictment specifically says at the end that the alleged conduct was outside the course of professional practice or for other than a legitimate medical purpose. So how does that not put your client on notice, as you just described, for purposes of creating a defense?
Because there are numerous ways to respond to that. Because
you have a few. I think the chiefs are going to give you only a few minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You can answer her question. Take as much time as you need.
Thank you. Specifically, after the first indictment came down and we filed a motion to dismiss the charges, the government filed a motion for a bill of particulars, said these are false and fraudulent. Okay, then we theoretically at that point had some notice. But then the government sought to introduce other evidence that wasn't whether or not they were false and fraudulent and therefore not actually issued by a prescriber, but that even if they had been issued by a prescriber, they should not have been filled. It's sort of the red flag type of testimony, things that he should have known, that you could look at the prescriptions and see that reasonable prescribers would not have addressed this.
And they have 72 counts. They identify every prescription. They tell you exactly what prescription they're talking about. They tell you the elements of the offense. And I know this isn't enough to overcome a deficient indictment, but they even later give you the theory of the case when the district court orders them to do so, and they tell you even more about what, you know, that they're relying on this idea of red flags.
As someone who was litigating the case, I will tell you it was very up and down. It was very, it could be this, and then, oh, we're going to do this in addition to that, and it can also be this. And so it was only after we repeatedly litigated these issues that the government had to respond to the bill of particulars and sort of try and narrow it down.
But you get still, the bill of particulars a year before trial.
They did, but you're, yes, as you recognize, Your Honor, that does not cure a deficient indictment.
I grant you that, but also an indictment doesn't have to give you their theory of the case.
I agree that it doesn't have to give the entire theory of the case. It doesn't have to point out specific evidence. I agree that it doesn't have to put out a roadmap of the mm-hmm. of the government's case. I agree with that. What I think that the indictment needed to say was, these prescriptions were false or fraudulent, mm-hmm. or that these prescriptions were issued by a prescriber not in the normal course of...
Okay. I think we understand your case, Ms. Webster. You've saved 5 minutes. Let's hear from Ms. Spritzer.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Erin Spritzer for the United States, and I was also trial counsel in this case. Turning to the issue raised by Benedio about the testimony regarding other investigations and the investigation of this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it allowed that testimony about the investigation of this case and others. Benedio's defense, as this court has noted in its questioning, was that he was duped by schemers engaged in criminal activity at Express Medical. He mentioned this directly in his opening statement when he referred to two of the government's witnesses as convicted felons and explained their conduct. Time and time again over the course of the government's case, Benedio elicited evidence on cross-examination through government's witnesses about the criminal activity of others. During the cross of Ms. Carter, defense counsel asked about other doctors at Express Medical, asked about the trial that Ms. Carter had testified to, even introduced a line sheet from a wiretap investigation. There was much evidence presented about the criminal convictions, criminal behavior of others that was not elicited by the government.
So I'm understanding your friend across the aisle to be saying, maybe I've got it wrong and she'll correct me if so, I'm sure when she gets up on reply, but I understand her to be saying that they drew a distinction between those witnesses or those individuals who presented false and forged prescriptions versus those prescriptions that were issued that weren't issued in the usual course of business. In other words, that her client was duped by the false and fraudulent prescriptions because the people who prepared those, were able to dupe him. So that was fine to introduce all of the evidence about how they had been convicted and these types of things. But with respect to the prescriptions for which he was charged filling outside the ordinary course or the usual course, for those, that introducing the convictions of the people responsible for those was inconsistent with their theory of the case. And so that caused them some kind of, prejudice. And so I guess I want to hear from you if you have a response to that.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there was such a clean distinction. The activities at Express Medical were introduced time and time again by defendant in this case, and although 69 of the charged counts were, the theory was that those prescriptions were fake or fraudulent, defense counsel in its opening and explaining its defense never differentiated between those 69 prescriptions and the three prescriptions that were actually issued by a physician in this case. There was no line drawn between those two. The defense theory did not change based on the prescription itself. It was an overarching theory that Bonadio had been duped by different schemers and people who were presenting these prescriptions, whether they be false or fraudulent or written by a doctor impermissibly. And because the theory, defense's theory, was the same regarding both, the conviction of anyone at Express Health that was brought in by defendant or raised in any way didn't make any material difference here because it was all part of the same theory of defense. And further, Your Honor, the convictions that I believe Bonadio was referring to that were mentioned by Investigator Allen, he doesn't name anyone other than Charlyn Carter, who had already been named by Bonadio in opening statement and other times throughout the course of the government's case. He merely mentions
that... He does refer to the doctor.
Yes, Your Honor. He does refer to a doctor...
Not by name, and he refers to the clinic owner, not by name, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. He also referred to sponsors, again, not by name. And the cases brought up by Bonadio refer to cases where the government introduced convictions of co-conspirators. That did not happen in this case. Bonadio was the sole defendant. He acted alone. There was no charged conspiracy. These were unnamed individuals. One comment made over the course of a two-week trial by a government witness. And the cases are not on point because, again, they do not refer here. There was no reference to any co-conspirators who were also convicted. And for those reasons, it's different.
I had a question about the fine. There may be other issues in terms of the evidence, but in this case, it's my understanding that the only reason why Mr. Bonadio didn't object to the fine is because his attorney admittedly failed to respond to the probation officer's request for such information. It's also my understanding that because of that failure to object, that issue is here on plain error review. But my question has to do with, why wouldn't it be in and of itself a manifest injustice for him to have been penalized, essentially, for his attorney's failure to comply?
Your Honor, defendant is bound, and this court holds responsible, defendant's attorney, and this forum is not the proper avenue to address that perceived injustice. Here
is that what is what you mean is this. Look, the pre-sentence investigation report asserted that he was able to pay the fine.
Yes, Your Honor.
He did not object to that, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And our precedents say that the failure to object is an admission of that fact. So under our precedents, counsel's failure to object means he has admitted he is able to pay the fine.
That's correct, Your Honor. This court's holding in Hernandez states that the burden lies with defendant to establish his present and future inability to pay a fine. Because he did not object to the pre-sentence report, which stated facts about his income and his finances, and then he did not object.
Well, again, I think it is important to recognize it's not that he didn't object, it's that his representative, through his attorney, failed to respond to the probation officer's request. So essentially, it's not that he didn't have the opportunity to contest that through no fault of his own. And that's why I'm asking, why is that not in and of itself a form of manifest injustice to Mr. Bonadio or Bonadio?
Your Honor, under this court's precedent, defendant had admitted that he was able to pay a fine because he did not object to the PSR. I understand Your Honor's point about an injustice, but this is not the proper forum to address that issue. There are many instances where defendants are held responsible for the actions of their attorneys, and here, Bonadio
did... Let's talk about the guideline.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I understand how the guideline works here, is that the guideline says the district court is required to impose a fine unless the defendant is able to establish that he's unable to pay. So the defendant actually has the burden to establish that, right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The guideline section 5E1.2A states that a district court shall impose a fine except if the defendant can establish his inability to pay. And here, defendant did not establish that.
Again, the question is not whether or not the burden was on the defendant. That is clearly established as the guidelines articulate. The question is, how can a defendant be held responsible for not meeting a burden when it was not in his ability to meet it because of his attorney's failure?
Your Honor, defendant did have the opportunity to meet directly with the probation officer. In holding that a fine within the guideline range was appropriate here, the district court explained that, quote, Mr. Benedio and his family just refused to cooperate in any investigation by the probation officer into what his financial circumstances were.
Let me ask you this. If counsel was deficient in his performance, is that something that Mr. Benedio would be able to challenge in a motion to vacate under 2255?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. Because this court
I'm not saying it would succeed.
I understand, Your Honor. Yes, he...
I'm asking if there was deficient performance, a failure of effective assistance of counsel... The way you establish a record about that is in collateral review under 2255. Am I right about that?
Yes, Your Honor is correct that 2255 would be the proper forum to bring up an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel and not this current appeal.
Not a direct appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the argument, and again, we can move on from this, is not an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Again, it's that he was unable to meet his burden. Perhaps you cannot detach the two in terms of the reason why he can't meet his burden. But I do think that's an important distinction that's being made in terms of one of Mr. Benedio's arguments on appeal.
I understand, Your Honor, and I do believe that they are intertwined together. But Mr. Benedio was afforded the opportunity to be interviewed by probation and had three different opportunities, albeit through his counsel, to object to the PSR, to write in his sentencing memorandum about a fine, or to discuss his inability to pay at the sentencing hearing. He failed to do so each time, whether that be himself or through counsel. Mm-hmm. And, Your Honors, even if this court were to find that there was any error here, which the government submits there was not, there was overwhelming unchallenged evidence of guilt against defendant admitted at trial, and any error would be harmless. The jury heard from a witness, Diane Fikes, a known drug dealer, who stated she printed fake prescriptions in Benedio's pharmacy and he filled them knowing they were fake. Charlene Carter, who we've discussed, who worked at Express Medical, told Benedio that a doctor who wrote some of the purported prescriptions he was filling on an Express Medical prescription pad no longer worked there. Drug addicts told the jury they came from out of state, traveling hundreds of miles just to fill prescriptions at Benedio's pharmacy. They passed numerous pharmacies on the way there, but still drove to Georgia, to Mableton, to his pharmacy, because they knew he would fill those prescriptions. And they paid exorbitant amounts of money for those prescriptions, often in cash, up between $800 and $1,000 per prescription, which was about 10 times the price at another pharmacy. The witnesses knew Benedio would give them drugs when no one else would. Not one, but two drug wholesale distributors cut Benedio off because of his practice of purchasing such large amounts of opioids and other controlled substances, which was indicative of diversion. The jury heard from doctors, law enforcement witnesses about the glaring errors on the prescriptions that Benedio filled that were missing signatures, dosage amounts, and other vital information. And after all of that evidence, Benedetto testified on his own behalf, and as this court has held, the jury was entitled to disbelieve him. Benedetto testified extensively about those same mistakes on the faces of the prescriptions themselves that he filled. He acknowledged that they were not valid prescriptions and called it an oversight. He also testified he charged significantly more than other pharmacies for controlled substances at about 100% markup. And he admitted that it was his responsibility as a pharmacist to evaluate prescriptions for their validity and legitimacy. This mountain of evidence makes any error in admitting the challenged testimony harmless. And if there are no further questions, we ask the court to affirm the convictions and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spritzer. Mr. Mutt Webster, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. To address some of the points that were made in the government's argument, first, the government says that we have only cited cases that involve co-conspirators. That's not accurate. The Nickerson decision referred to a defendant who or a witness who testified that he had previously testified about in 13 other convictions. That case was not about co-conspirators, and that was error, even if the court determined that it was not harmless in light of a curative instruction. Second, to address Judge Rosenbaum's question, just to be
let me ask you though, Eason and Griffin were both co-conspirators, right?
Eason was. Yes, that's correct. Although they weren't charged together. I think in Eason, the father was previously charged like years earlier. Mm. I think there's also an argument to be made that...
Prosecutor was asking leading questions, right, that stated the facts of the co-conspirator's exact charge and that he was convicted, right?
In Eason. Yes, in that case. There are numerous other decisions that we have cited in a brief where it wasn't that explicit, but I just wanted to address that point as well. And Jason Allen's testimony, he testified specifically that he was the case agent on the Express Health investigation and then listed people by name, Charlene Carter, Anthony Licata, Dr. Romy Rowland, Dr. Batista, Dr. Murtaugh, Dr. Tan. And then the government said, well, what happened to them? After they've already told the court that they intended to elicit evidence from law enforcement that the prescriptions filled at Better Way Pharmacy were filled.
What happened to them?
I'm sorry?
And what happened to them? And the witness testifies to exactly what defense counsel has told him in opening statement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's not correct. We argued and said that the people who were bringing him the prescriptions were part of a criminal scheme. Not that
you told him Carter's a convicted felon.
And she was able to testify, and we were able to cross-examine her, which is not the case for the other people who were told that this about. And I think that's a critical difference because that's one of the harms that the court talks about, is that you have the ability to cross-examine the witnesses or the investigation. And here we did not have that and explicitly objected to not even getting discovery on some of this evidence. So
y'all referred to it as a pill mill.
But not that they've been convicted, Your Honor, which is, I think, the critical point here, that they had been not just investigated or not just operating in a criminal scheme, but that they had been indicted, which means that they had been, a grand jury had found that there was probable cause to charge them, and then that they had been convicted either by a jury or by a judge through a plea. And so that allowed the jury to say, we can, like, these are people who have already been convicted. These are juries that have already made this determination. Why should we not just go with the same defense?
But y'all referred to people like Express, right? I mean, the places like Express was specifically referenced in opening statement.
But not that they had been convicted of a crime, Your Honor. And I understand your point, but we maintain that what we said an opening was not the same as the evidence that we have challenged, and that it was intentional by the government because they stood up at the pretrial conference and said this is exactly what we're trying to admit. So I would also reference the court to the testimony involving Officer Grimwad, which is at document 373, 71 through 72, and there the government did elicit it initially and intentionally, where there was a video and the government stopped and said, which doctor was he referencing there? And that was Dr. Svet. And then the government says, who is Dr. Svet? And then the officer responds that he was another doctor that we were investigating who had been at the clinic. That was intentionally elicited. That is not something that we elicited or that was done by accident. To address the harm again, the idea that the evidence that was cited and discussed by the government and its argument was not challenged is not accurate. We challenged that testimony at trial, and I understand that in determining a sufficiency issue, we resolve our issues in favor of the verdict. But here, when the burden is flipped, the burden is on the government because these are harmless error analysis. This is a harmless error analysis, and if you look at I believe it's this court's Rodriguez decision from the 2005, it says that the burden makes the difference, and here the burden is on the government. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. You were court appointed, and we appreciate you accepting the appointment and discharging your responsibility today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hans Jurgens versus Bailey.